This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. On the program today, an expert on treating asbestos-related diseases is not happy with the state underfunding the asbestos remediation program.
You would think that the people in Lansing would have had enough experience with abusing the public health and the public trust because of the Flint situation that they would be acting right about this, but they're acting like bad people.
How big is the foster family shortage?
Probably thousands, to be quite honest with you.
We'll hear from one of the candidates for governor.
I will improve the quality of life for average Michiganders.
And a group helping African-American women get through times of grief even when they're too busy.
They just keep doing what they do, being mamas and teachers and doctors and lawyers and showing up in their community in the way that we do and not having taken the time to process their grief.
But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham and for Cynthia Canty. Coming up later on the program...
I worked as a janitor during my high school and during my college to pull my family out of poverty.
We will hear from one of the candidates for governor. But first, this week there were a couple of stories about asbestos. The Detroit Free Press had an investigative piece about how the quick pace of demolition of abandoned homes and buildings in Detroit might be endangering residents. The city says that's demonstrably false. It's a good report. You should look it up. Then yesterday, Michigan's Auditor General found the state's asbestos remediation program needs more inspectors and more money. The program is falling behind in its reports and follow-up visits, according to a story Michigan Radio's Rick Pluta filed. Dr. Michael Harbutt is a specialist in occupational medicine and an expert on treating asbestos-related illnesses at St. John's Providence in Farmington Hills. Doctor, remind us what asbestos is and why it's a health hazard.
Asbestos is a fiber which is found naturally, which when mined works as a great insulator for heat and for electrical transmission. It helps keep buildings warm. It was actually called a miracle fiber for decades until it was learned that it was miraculous if you survived inhaling the asbestos fiber, in that the asbestos fibers can be breathed in very small amounts and cause scarring of the lungs, shortness of breath, lung cancer, mesothelioma, which is a particular kind of cancer caused only by asbestos in the United States, and actually an increase in colon cancer as well. If you're exposed to asbestos, you have about twice the risk of getting colon cancer than the rest of the population. So it's a fiber which has been used, the term that is actually quite appropriate is ubiquitously. It's a fiber that's been ubiquitously in American and Western European construction, literally hundreds of years, to help insulate against electric shocks, temperature changes, and fire.
Are we still using it?
Yeah, actually, one of the crazy things is that a lot of people believe that asbestos has been outlawed, when in fact it has not. And in fact, if it's used at than 1% of a mixture of other harmful or even benign components, at 1%, the manufacturer does not have to report it to the people who use it. And this is especially, this is just craziness, actually. If you think, people say, oh, what's 1% of asbestos? Well, if you take 2 50-pound bags of cement, which are known to be contaminated with asbestos, that would be 1 pound of asbestos in those two bags. So somebody who's repairing a sidewalk and uses a couple of bags of cement dust with an asbestos contaminate is breathing in a pound of asbestos fiber.
At what level of exposure to asbestos would be a cause for concern?
In the study of the epidemiology of asbestos fibers and most carcinogens, the general scientific thought is there is no such thing as a safe exposure. Now, if you're exposed to very low levels in only a very few numbers of times, then the risk of getting asbestos cancer is lower than somebody who's exposed to higher amounts over a longer period of time. But the reality is that there is no such thing as a safe exposure to asbestos. And these guys at the state level, I think, to be generous, might be called challenged, either you know, I just can't think of a nice thing to say about them. So I guess, like my mom told me,
yeah, because of the shortfall in money, we're not funding that program as it should be. Is that what you mean?
Well, yeah, it's crazy. If you don't feed your kids for lunch, you probably have more money to go to the casino. Well, if you don't fund the asbestos inspection and remediation people, you have money left over to do something less important. You would think that the people in Lansing would have had enough experience with abusing the public health and the public trust because of the Flint situation, that they would be acting right about this. But they're acting like bad people.
And these demolitions in Detroit, or for that matter, anywhere, is the asbestos supposed to be removed from a structure before demolition?
Yeah, it's supposed to be, because when you tear something down that's insulated with asbestos fibers, you free it to the air. Now, it's carried by the wind one place or another, but more significantly, when the demolition product or when the torn-down house is taken away, there are people who are working at demolition and at removal who breathe in all of that fiber that's been left on the demolition product. So it's supposed to be removed. And I think it was in St. Louis a number of years ago, the St. Louis government tried wetting the asbestos in a building before removing it. And there was little or no scientific support for doing that. It just made sense to a lot of people. And it may make sense to some extent, but it's not the right way to do it, and it doesn't make life-saving sense.
When I've seen demolitions in Detroit, sometimes I see someone with a hose spraying water to try to keep the dust to a minimum. Sometimes there's not someone with a hose. If there is asbestos, how adequate would spraying water prevent the asbestos dust from flying around beyond the demolition site?
Now, it's cosmetic, you know. It's cosmetic. The asbestos has to be removed. Those rules and those laws were adopted with good reason. And there were health groups and groups representing the workers, the unions, who fought long and hard to have those rules instituted to protect the lives of people, not only people tearing it down, but people exposed incidentally to asbestos fiber, like kids. This is a very significant problem. The asbestos fiber still kills, always will kill. Water is not good enough.
If you live next to a demolition site and you're worried about asbestos dust, what precautions can you take?
Call a higher authority than the state to put a stop to it. I'm not exactly sure what you can do. If we're at the point where the state government doesn't care a hoot about the people's health, then I guess that leaves the federal government. But I've actually seen patients from some of the demolition projects downtown in the last 30, 35 years since I've been practicing medicine, in this specialty in particular. There was the lead released from the old Hudson's building, but there were asbestos fibers identified in the schoolyard near where it used to be the old library downtown. There were asbestos fibers identified. So it is a problem. It's not going away.
Dr. Michael Harbutt is a specialist in occupational medicine and an expert on treating asbestos-related illnesses at St. John's Providence in Farmington Hills. He's also a professor of medicine at Michigan State University. Thanks for taking the time to tell us about this.
Thanks for being interested in it. Maybe you can help save a few lives.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio.
What are we going to do?
Road trip.
Today we head to Mansalona, where a local diner opened 6 years ago, just as the town was falling on hard times. The Iron Skillet is known for its slow-smoked brisket, its pig iron omelet, and its dedication to the community. Interlochen Public Radio's Aaron Selbig reports.
As you pull into Mansalona, the highway narrows. It follows alongside railroad tracks, past a couple of abandoned warehouses, and then there it is, a red, white, and blue chicken, the unofficial mascot of the Iron Skillet. It's early morning and people are digging into their omelets and biscuits and gravy. Chuck Johnson and Mel Kitchen are sipping coffee together, talking about three of their favorite topics: politics, snowmobiles, and fishing. Mel just returned from a fishing trip in Florida.
I brought a whole freezer full home. Porgies and hogfish and groupers and mutton snappers, about everything in the ocean.
Mel's buddy Chuck has been driving a school bus just for something to do since he retired. Both men have lived in Mansalona all their lives. Chuck says the town hasn't been the same since the Dura Automotive plant closed 8 years ago, taking 300 jobs with it.
It's a drive-through town now. You know, just drive through here, go
go north or they turn and go west to the resorts or to the lakes.
Well, it's like all the towns. They're shrinking, all the little towns of losing their industry, losing their jobs. I mean, there's no difference here than any other where in Michigan, all the way down in Florida.
The automotive plant was the last of three large factories to close in Mancelona. And not only has the town lost many of its jobs, but one of those factories poisoned the town's well water. It's been a tough few years, but Chuck and Mel think the town can come back. So does Mike Nygren, owner of the Iron Skillet. Nygren has been in the restaurant business since he was a kid.
It was definitely a fast-paced kind of life.
His parents owned a pizza place downstate.
I was always working in the restaurant growing up. There were times where I'd even get called out of school to go help cook at the restaurant when they were slammed.
Nygren takes that family approach with the Iron Skillet, which he opened 6 years ago. It's reflected in his food, which is all made from scratch.
To me, having a business in a small town is all about being part of the community, not only for us to make money, but for the community to grow.
Nygren donates some of the Iron Skillet's profits to local charities, and he holds fundraisers at the diner for families in need. He says his diner can help Mancelona rebound, and part of that is taking care of his employees.
Yeah, it's really cool to see multiple people that have worked here for years growing and buying their own houses, and they're able to do that because they are making a good living here, and it gives me a sense of gratification.
Nygren says business at the Iron Skillet has been good thanks to regulars like Mel Kitchen.
Oh, it's home. It's a good place. We could just use more jobs for the younger people.
Mel says the Iron Skillet is part of the solution.
That story was produced by Aaron Selbig of Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, which one is the tallest waterfall in the state of Michigan? We answer an Am I Curious question, and then we go to one of the facilitators of Where Do Black Women Go to Grieve?
They keep chugging along. They just keep doing what they do, being mamas and teachers and doctors and lawyers and showing up in their community in the way that we do and not having taken the time to process their grief.
That talk in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. Hi there. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty.
What?
When?
Why?
I am curious.
Let's do another round of Am I Curious, where you ask the question, we find the answer. And today's question comes from Jim Curtis. He lives in Amik, which is in the Keweenaw Peninsula, which is one of my favorite spots on the planet. Jim, what's your question?
Hey, guys. Yeah, my question is, what is the tallest waterfall in Michigan, and how is that figured out?
And what got you thinking about that question?
Well, I live not far from the Houghton-Douglas Falls, or Douglas-Houghton Falls. People argue about the name of it, but we'll just call it Houghton Falls. And that is pretty tall, and I'm wondering if that is the tallest one.
Well, we turn to Michigan Department of Natural Resources for the answer. John Pepin keeps tracks of things like that. John, tallest waterfall?
Well, tallest waterfall, it's kind of a subjective thing in some ways, but I would concur that the Douglas Houghton Falls is at 110 feet is the tallest waterfall in Michigan.
Pretty good guess, Jim. So 110 feet, how do you measure a waterfall?
Well, see, that's where you start getting into the ambiguity of things. There's lots of different ways people do it. Some are more accurate than others. Some people go up, say you're up, which is kind of a dangerous method. You go up to the top of the falls and then throw a plumb line over the falls and where it hits the plunge pool or the bottom. Then you mark it off, and then you go and measure how far that is. Or there's another way where it's called the gravity method, where you can toss a coin or something and count how long it takes to fall to the bottom and then employ some physics to that to try to...
Yeah, that involves a lot too much math for me, I think.
Right, and it's very loud at a waterfall, too, so you might not even hear a coin or a rock hit the bottom when you do that. And then there's another one, the old kind of a reference thing where you go, okay, I know this person's 6 foot tall, so if you see a person standing at the base of the falls, you can sort of extrapolate there might be, 10 of this person for a 60-foot high waterfall. Or you can look on a contour lines on a topographic map, and that is another way that some people figure that out. But then there's all the question of where does a waterfall begin and end? because sometimes there's cascades leading into a waterfall or tailing out at the bottom end of it. So do those cascades count as part of the waterfall, or is it just the vertical plunge, the waterfall? And some people will debate that. And also, if a waterfall has more than one waterfall, where does one begin and where does the other one end? And what if the creek splits? So if the creek splits, is the waterfall on both sides of the creek, are those also included in the height, or is it just the one? So there's all these different things.
Well, what method did you guys use to measure the Douglas Houghton or the Houghton
Douglas
Falls?
Well, I don't know that we've measured it specifically, but I would say the most accurate way to measure it is they use trigonometry and a clinometer and a rangefinder when you actually want to measure it. Now, I noticed that when we looked at the falls as far as the possible purchase of property to make it accessible to the public, they didn't put a height for the falls, and they just let it go at saying it's, you know, among the highest waterfalls in Michigan. But the competitors, I mean, would seem to fall short. I mean, you have like the Laughing Whitefish Falls in Alger County is 100 feet. And then very impressive is Spray Falls, which is at Pictured Rocks National Lakeshore. That's 70 feet, although it looks a lot larger. It goes off the rock cliffs into Lake Superior. And then, of course, tallest is one thing people talk about. Well, what's most impressive? And you often hear Tequamanon Falls is most impressive, but it's only about 50 feet high, but it's 200 feet across. So a lot of people say that's the largest waterfall.
Well, let's nail down some things about Houghton Douglas or Douglas Houghton. Which is it? Is there a preferred choice? I was reading the Keweenaw report says they're going to go with Douglas Houghton.
Yeah, it's my understanding, unless there's something else locally there that I'm unaware of, Douglas Houghton is who it's named after, who's the state's first geologist, and also Houghton County. And there's a lot of Houghton references, and I think that part is clear just based on the fact that, you know, there's two S's in Douglas, like the geologist. So
that was the other thing I was going to ask you about, because Michigan Technological University has a site about the falls, and they use one S in their Douglas.
Well, I think that's kind of a map thing. We recently had a thing come up about a creek name. We were looking at all our different maps, and it was spelled three or four different ways on the maps.
Hmm. I also saw that the state is involved in the purchase of land that you mentioned there. Is that complete? Is it available to the public? Can we go see it?
Well, not just yet. What's happening there is in 2015, the Michigan Natural Resources Trust Fund, the Trust Fund Board, the state legislature, and the governor approved a $600,000 acquisition grant to acquire about 80 acres there, which would include the Hamel Creek Gorge and also the Douglas Houghton Falls. And right now the property is currently being appraised, and then once we get the appraisals back, the DNR Real Estate Services will review the appraisals and then negotiate with the landowner and make an offer. And then if the offer is accepted, our target looks like the DNR could then close on the property by the end of the year.
Yeah, I guess I'm glad you mentioned Hamel Creek. It's good to know what creek the falls are on. Jim, do you have any follow-up questions for John?
Well, actually, you guys just covered what I was hoping to hear about, because we have heard about the efforts from, I think it's Calumet Township and the state and everybody working together, which is really awesome because it's a wonderful state resource, and we'd love to have it available to the public, but for safety reasons, of course, it's been closed since it's on private land, and, you know, it can be dangerous. So, yeah, don't try and go there now, but let's all work together and get that thing available to the public.
That is Jim Curtis. He had our question for Am I Curious, and that is, what is the tallest falls? And our answer came from John Peppam with Michigan Department of Natural Resources, and the answer is Douglas Houghton Falls, not too far from Houghton on Hamel Creek. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
If you've got a Michigan or an Am I Curious question for us to dig into, you can submit it on the stateside page at michiganradio.org.
Collaborative, heart of the community. The next idea. When we really see each other, we want to help each other.
You know, we live in a world of stereotypes, as disappointing as that can be sometimes, and here's one of them. Black women never take any guff from anyone, and they are always strong. Well, no one is always strong. Bad things in life happen and we experience tragedies. So when an African-American woman, a strong woman, is struggling with loss, struggling with grief, where can she turn? Patrice Lucas is working on that. She says being a strong black woman frequently means feeling enormous pressure to hold in her feelings. Patrice Lucas joins me now. You are a facilitator of something called Where Do Black Women Go to Grieve? How did that group come about?
So it's actually not my own group. I'm the licensed mental health counselor that was invited to join the group at the invitation of Etta Fly of Naturally Fly Detroit. She experienced grief and loss about 3 years ago when her partner passed away. And in that experience, she wanted to create opportunity for other black women to have a place to not be okay. And in that, we partnered, and she invited me to come and kind of help her get this started and get her group, Where Do Black Women Go to Grieve, which is part of her organization, Good Grief Detroit, going and started. And from there, we began meeting every Monday, first and third Monday of the month, at her family's bakery, Sweet Potato Sensations.
Oh, yeah, I know where that's at. It's right across from Motor City Java, same block as Redford Theater.
That's right. So on a Monday evening, on the first and third of every month, Etta Fly opens her family's business when it's closed, and she invites black women into a safe place to grieve. She invited me along on that journey, and that's kind of where Do Black Women Go to Grieve all got started.
I know not everybody's the same, but I'm wondering what keeps black women from going to a grief counselor or something like that?
So it's really the stigma associated with mental health care in the black community. And that stigma really starts kind of anywhere any stigma starts. And it does start with the idea that you mentioned at the beginning of the show, that this idea of being strong. We have to be strong. We just have to keep going. But the reality is there hasn't been a luxury for African Americans and women specifically to have the opportunity to really explore their grief, explore their trauma, explore their pain. But a lot of times, you know, in the black community, we kind of want to fix our own problems because when we share about our problems, we're marginalized even further because of them. And, you know, we have a strong religious beliefs and strong religious faith in the community. So a lot of times we think, oh, I'm going to take my troubles to the church. I'm going to pray about it. And culturally, we really just have not taken the opportunity for a lot of different reasons to not only participate in mental health care, but even in physical health care.
So how do you reach out to women who might need this help? Do you actively seek them out, or do they find out about you and come to you?
So we do. So Etta Fly and myself, one of the things that we do is we promote on social media. So we promote on both of our liked pages and business pages. At the bakery, Etta actually provides some flyers and information and as people come in. And then it's really word of mouth. So for me, I have a client base, and I share with my clients because I do a lot of grief and loss work individually and in the community. So in that space, I share about my work, and I invite women to come to grief group. Etta does the same. I mean, literally, sometimes we are in the Whole Foods, and people are stopping us like, hey, you guys do a grief group, and I'm experiencing this, and then we invite them to come on over. So it's really referral-based, but also on social media and kind of word of mouth.
Are some of these women surprised about how grief is affecting their life?
Absolutely. So every group, the women are often surprised by, you know, the stories that is shared by other women, but also how they are impacted by grief and how it's really been, in a lot of ways, and sometimes crippling to their lives or impacting how they function, right? So again, you talked about this strong black woman. So when I talk about functioning with my individual clients or even with grief group, I kind of have to kind of buffer it or frame it for African Americans, because the reality is, since the days of slavery, we've always had to go to work regardless of what is happening in our personal lives. And again, that's really a luxury, a privilege to have the opportunity to really just sit down and take the time to process and rest. Sometimes that's because of financial strains, but sometimes it's also cultural as well. And so what happens is they keep chugging along. They just keep doing what they do, being mamas and teachers and doctors and lawyers and showing up in their community in the way that we do and not having taken the time to process their grief. So they're surprised when they come to grief group, or they're surprised when other women are talking about it, and they're hearing that idea of, me too. It's hard for me too. Yeah, I go to work every day, but I cry in my car for 5 minutes or 50 minutes before I walk in the building, or I'm crying on lunch.
Yeah, I wanted to get to what happens to people when they don't have a safe place to express their grief.
So what happens is the grief actually manifests itself in the body as a physical symptom sometimes.
So, like stress does to you.
So absolutely, like stress. So it's a stressor on the body. And that stressor, grief, then in turn manifests sometimes into physical conditions. So that's where we get the headaches, and that's where we even get the stomach ailments. Sometimes it can even manifest itself into other sicknesses and disease into the body.
I have to ask you this. What do you get out of this? I mean, why put yourself through the emotion of someone else hurting so much?
So I do it because one of the things that really helped me in my own pain and loss and in my own traumas growing up is the community. So growing up, my father was a heroin addict, and my mother had what's called agoraphobic panic disorder. And for many, many years, I really did carry around the shame of that experience, my life experience. And then one day I'm literally kind of on the bus with a group of friends, cheerleaders at Pershing High School, and we're catching a bus to Eastland Mall. And we just began to share. And everybody really in that space shared about maybe what their parent challenges were or their individual challenges, some of their trauma. And all of us was kind of just saying, me too. And from that day on, it was like a cloud, the shame cloud, was lifted off of me, right? And I didn't feel so alone in my pain. And from that moment, I wanted to help other people have that same experience. So that's why I went into counseling. I became an individual counselor, but also why I do groups and then why I go into the community to share about mental health, in particular grief.
After women who have gone through where do black women go to grieve and find improvement, do they keep in touch? Do they want to help as well?
So they do. Some women reach out and they support. We have a lot of different clinicians that come to the group. So surprisingly, it's clinician heavy. What that means is a lot of social workers come to the group, a lot of other mental health counselors, because, again, it's often hard for even what I sometimes call people in the healing professions to find the support and help they need. So what that happens is they then lend their support or offer referrals or, you know, so many beautiful friendships have come out of grief group and sister circles and girl groups and, you know, just new opportunities for some of the women has come up.
I'm going to put you on the spot just a little bit. What do you want to say to all the strong black women out there who are holding in all those feelings of loss?
So I want to say that, number one, it's okay not to be okay. And it is absolutely not only a stereotype, but also a myth that everyone is always strong. I think that idea is killing the majority of us, right? And it's not just killing strong black women. It's killing strong white women. And it's also killing all of our very strong and powerful men. The idea that we must always be okay or put on this mask of, I'm okay, I have it all together. Look at me, I can still be fabulous and amazing and all these things. So it's okay not to be okay. And the real message is I want to say that even as a licensed mental health counselor, even someone that does this work on a daily basis, there are times when I, too, am not okay. And so I just want to really say to them is, me too.
That is Patrice Lucas. She's with the group Where Do Black Women Go to Grieve? I want to thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you, and I appreciate you really opening up a platform for this conversation and more conversations about mental health.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Coming up, not many people become foster parents.
Because they feel like they have to have this grand or large home. They feel like they have to make, hundreds of thousands of dollars a year to be foster parents, and that's not the case.
But there's a desperate need for more of them in Michigan.
As far as how many families would take to meet that need, probably thousands, to be quite honest with you.
That's after the break. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. Michigan has a shortage. There are thousands of children who need foster families, but far fewer families willing to help. Here to talk about that are Shireen Allen Youngblood. She's a community outreach specialist with the Children's Center in Wayne County. She recruits foster parents. And Shanti Frazier Hall, who along with her husband is a foster parent. Shireen, why is there this shortage of families willing to foster kids?
Well, I think there's a shortage because a lot of people have a misconception about what foster care is, and just sometimes they just don't want to make the jump just yet because they're still in the process of thinking about it.
What's holding them back? What are the barriers? What are some of the myths that people think are hold?
Well, some of the myths I definitely think as far as why people don't become foster parents because they feel like they have to have this grand or large home. They feel like they have to make hundreds of thousands of dollars a year to be foster parents, and that's not the case. You only have to be 18 to be a foster parent. You only have, even if you work at McDonald's, you could be a foster parent. So as long as you're willing to open up a safe and loving home, you don't have to live in a large house. You can rent, you can own, whatever your living situation may be.
I saw there's something like 13,000 foster kids without homes, and about 5,000 of those kids are in Wayne County. How many families would it take to meet that need?
As far as how many families would take to meet that need, probably thousands, to be quite honest with you. So if we could start out with maybe getting 50, then we're on the right track.
Shanti, what led you to be a foster parent?
I wanted to be a foster parent because we were actually helping a friend of ours who had around 8 children. So we were
foster kids or
no,
just kids?
Just okay. Kids. And we decided once we returned her children back to her and she no longer needed our help, we wanted to do it on a more permanent basis.
How many kids in your house now?
3.
I have to ask you, we'll talk about ages in a second, but did you have some of those misperceptions about what a foster family might be and what it actually is?
Absolutely. When we first started the process, I thought that we needed to have lots of money and lots of space, but that wasn't the case. Once we went through the process and the licensing agent came out, she told us exactly how we would be a good fit for several children.
So you've got 3 kids. What are their ages?
We have a 4-year-old, a 2-year-old, and a 10-month-old.
How's that changed your life?
Oh, a lot. It's changed.
give me an example. What's different now?
Okay, mornings are very hectic because we actually have 3 biological children as well. So it's 6 children total. So adding 3
full little house.
Ones, yes, yes, absolutely. Adding 3 additional children to the paradigm has changed. It's awesome. It's an awesome feeling that you're actually helping some children out.
How have your biological kids accepted the foster kids?
They love them. They think it's an overnight stay, overnight party every night. So they love it.
Shireen, what kind of changes or what kind of advice would you have for people who are just considering being a foster parent?
I always say if they're just considering to just pick up the telephone and call me, and I can definitely answer all of those questions. I can walk them through the process and let them know. So that's really important. It's really just to pick up the telephone.
Now, money is always an issue. I mean, you've mentioned that, you know, people feel like they have to have a lot of wealth in order to be a foster parent. But
right.
There is some help that comes along with this, right?
It is. It's called a reimbursement. And it, depending on the age of the child and the needs of that child, will depend on how much you're reimbursed. Does it cover the full cost of having a child? No, but it is a little bit to help along the way.
So typically, how long does a foster kid stay with a family?
It really depends on each case, but I would say an average time frame would run around 9 to 12 months when we're reunifying. But I always say a more realistic time frame, honestly, is 18 to 24 months.
I don't know if this is true, but I hear people speak this way. They're worried about that troubled kid who comes in that's a real problem. Is that common? And if so, how do parents deal with that?
As far as one of the great things about the Children's Center is that we have behavioral health services that we can provide to help if a troubled youth is placed in your home. But I wouldn't place a troubled youth in somebody's home if that's not what they're prepared to deal with. We're going to place what would be what we would call general behaviors or normal, use the term loosely, that a child would have.
Shante, what would you recommend or what advice would you have for a family that's thinking about becoming foster parents?
Definitely to contact their local adoption foster care agency and start researching, because, I mean, it has changed our lives. It's been the best experience.
So from your personal experiences, what advice would you tell them?
I would tell them to...
Well, what should they brace for, I guess?
Well, be prepared to co-parent with the biological family. Be open-minded to the behaviors that children may come with. Pack your patience, because you're going to need lots of it and lots of love to give to the children.
Shereen, final question. What kind of changes to public policy might we need to solve the shortage? What can be done?
As far as public policy, I would definitely say more support in regards to the foster parents. Of course, financial, which I know is definitely difficult in this day and age. But or even support would be something with programs that support extracurricular activities, be it soccer, softball, baseball, whatever that sport that that child wants to play. Or actually for music, a child might want to take an instrument. Children need those instruments, and those instruments cost money.
And none of that's provided now.
Correct.
Okay. Well, sounds like some work needs to be done. Shereen Allen Youngblood is a community outreach specialist with the Children's Center in Wayne County. She recruits foster parents. And Shante Frazier-Hall, who along with her husband has now 6 kids in the house, 3 of them are foster kids. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
Next year, Michigan chooses a new governor. Several people have announced their candidacy, including our guest today, Sri Tanadar. He's running as a Democrat. Welcome.
Thank you.
What would you do for Michigan if elected governor?
I will improve the quality of life for average Michiganders. That's the overarching theme of my candidacy. Now, I would do that through certainly creating good-paying jobs, spurring up the economy. I am a small business person. And my focus is going to be more on investing in human beings as opposed to investing in corporate welfare that we see today. So my focus would be creating the skill sets, helping entrepreneurship, creating a startup culture, helping small businesses, overall spurring up the economy so that we'll create more good-paying jobs.
Now, I'll have to challenge you on that, because it's a fallacy that political people have that much influence on the economy. Yes, they can nudge it along a little bit. They can have a bit of influence, but the economy does what it wants to do regardless who's in office. So with that in mind, how are you going to spin up the economy?
Well, let me give you my example. In 2010, I had businesses all over America, chemical testing. I helped small companies innovate products, make new pharmaceuticals. Now, during the recession, like many Michigan businesses suffered, my business suffered as well. And I lost it all during the recession. And then I came to Ann Arbor, Michigan, bought a little place, bought some assets of a business that had gone out of business. And I restarted my business from scratch. And in the last 6 years, I created 50 high-paying jobs with average salaries of $75,000. So if we encourage people to do good for themselves, if we encourage entrepreneurship, the whole economy can impact, and government has a role in doing that.
During your candidacy announcement, you were critical of Governor Rick Snyder. You said you can't run government with a spreadsheet mentality. But as an entrepreneur, you're rich, you've never held political office, you live in Ann Arbor. I mean, you have more in common with Rick Snyder than not. So what makes you different from him?
Not really. Let me explain. When I was 14 years old, my father was forced to retire from his government job with no pension. And I worked as a janitor during my high school and during my college to pull my family out of poverty. So I know what it is like to go to bed hungry. And I'm probably the only candidate who knows what it is like to go to bed hungry. So I am not the same kind of a billion-dollar business mindset that Snyder is. I have built businesses from ground up. Now, when I came to United States in 1979 to get my PhD, and in 82, I got a job here in Ann Arbor, Michigan, as a chemist.
You've mentioned that when the recession hit, you lost a lot, including your house to foreclosure. You've made this comeback, as you have. You took a failing business and turned it around. Now, you can either see that as an inspirational story or a tale of caution. This guy does not have a solid track record all through his life. How do you present that to the people?
Well, Warren Buffett says that he never hires a CEO who hasn't failed before. You know, I am battle-tested. Now, in the recession, the reason my business failed is because the small companies who were my customers went belly up because there was no funding for long-term medical research. What happened was none of my fault. It happened with a lot of other businesses, including GM and Ford. Now, I was too small a business to get government subsidiaries, and the bank decided to foreclose on me. But I bounced right back, and I created a business that's continued to do well today.
So let's talk about state government. Basically, it's a $56 billion organization. You're the leader of 10 million people who live everywhere from a major American city to remote areas of the Upper Peninsula. What is it in your background that you think you can relate to all those people and deal with a corporation of $56 billion a year?
Good question. I bring a variety of skill sets. Not only I know what it is like to too difficult to make both ends meet. Today, 40% of Michiganders have some difficulty in supporting their family, putting food on the table. And I understand that because I have been in their shoes. Also, I have lived my American dream. I started businesses. Even though I failed once, I got up and made it success again. I am financially savvy. I know how to put together good teams. I know how to have a vision, and I certainly have a vision for Michigan, which is to improve the quality of life of every Michigander. And I know how to implement my vision, how to put together good people, very skilled set of people, because one person cannot do this all by himself or herself. So I will make sure, just like I've done in my businesses, that I will hire best of the best, and I will implement and make sure this vision becomes reality for Michigan.
You're a self-described progressive Democrat, and I'm wondering, progressive means different things to different people. What does progressive mean to you?
Well, a lot. Primarily, it's putting people over profits. That means I support a living wage. I support affordable education. Now, education should not be a privilege. Education should be everyone, regardless of their financial abilities, should have access to affordable education.
You're talking about higher education.
Higher education, trade education, vocational education, all of that. And I would like to see that community schools are free for every Michigander. I would like to see trade school training, vocational training brought into middle school and high school.
Now, when you say community schools, you mean like community colleges?
Yes.
Okay. Let's talk about a few issues that are facing the state. A good number of people face the possibility of losing health care coverage in Michigan, including a number of people who depend on Medicaid. What can or what would you do about that as governor?
Well, we certainly see what's going on in Washington, D.C. regarding trying to tinker with the health care. Now, the Affordable Care Act is not perfect and needs work. But what is going on in Washington, D.C. is very cruel. And if it succeeds, if it's going to throw off many more people out of coverage. Health care, again, should not be a privilege. Countries that are less fortunate than we are able to have medicine socialized and a lot more people covered under health care. I think if we put our minds to it, we should be able to come up with a plan where we can cover all of Michiganders for basic health care coverage.
And you think a governor can manage that?
Absolutely. Now, one thing I give credit to Governor Snyder is that his Healthy Michigan program. You know, he broke away from the Republican mindset and he accepted and expanded Medicaid, which helped increase coverage to many Michiganders.
Flint children are facing lasting issues because of being poisoned by lead in the water. What should the state of Michigan do about that?
Well, we need to replace those pipes. We need to ensure...
Which is underway. I was thinking more of the long-term welfare of the children. What should we do for them? What should the state be doing for them?
They absolutely must get the best health care. We need to ensure that children who are poisoned by lead and any lasting health effect that it could create needs to be observed. And we need to ensure that they live a healthy lives. Let's go back and look at the basis of this. What we did was we starved the cities of funds. When the cities failed, we put emergency managers on them. And the emergency managers only had control about cost. They did not have control over revenues. And such cost-cutting, looking at the bottom line, not caring or understanding that there are people involved behind those decisions. That's what really caused Flint.
There is some job growth in Michigan, quite a bit of job growth in Michigan, but labor participation is still down, lower than it should be, and wages are not going up at the same rate as, for instance, corporate profits. So what can or should a governor do about that?
Again, our focus tends to be give incentives to big corporations so that the corporations can come in, set up shops in Michigan.
Sure, trickle down.
Now, if you look at last 10 years, the corporations who have taken these hundreds of millions of dollars of incentives created jobs, and the corporations who have closed shop, what it looks like is the net gain of jobs is essentially zero, even though we have given away hundreds of millions of taxpayers' dollars. I think what I would like to do is take this money and invest in people. That means invest in creating those skill sets. If we have skilled workforce in Michigan, the corporations will come to Michigan and set up shop. So we need to invest in people. We need to create those opportunities.
Final question. I want to talk about campaign money. What do you think of the ever-increasing amount of dark money that funds political campaigns today?
I totally dislike that. I think I will not take any dark money. I will not take any corporate money. As you know, I put my own money into my campaign. Today, the influence of dark money and the rich billion-dollar donor money, the PACs, have corrupted our political system. It has corrupted our government. And we have in Lansing a pay-for-play culture, and I want to destroy that culture. I think our loyalty must be for the people of Michigan. Now, what happens is politicians and career politicians do this as a way of life. They give all kinds of promises, tell people what they want to hear. Once they get in power, they start paying out to their donors and to this dark money. That needs to be stopped. I think in Michigan, we have probably a system much worse than anywhere else in the country.
Sri Tanadar is running for Democratic nomination for governor of Michigan. Thanks for coming in. I'm sure we'll talk again.
Absolutely, Lester. Thanks for inviting me.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings, engineered by Mike Blank. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Lindsay Scullin, and Mike Blank. He's a busy guy. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham, and for Cynthia Candy. Thanks for listening. Talk to you tomorrow.